Welcome to LeapCast. I'm your host, Dr. George James. LEAP stands for Leaders, Entertainers, Athletes, and Performers. And I'm on a journey to connect with high achievers and highlight their unexamined human moments. Tune in to learn how these high-achieving LEAP individuals were able to reach their greatest potential, face their most difficult challenges, and embrace the human moments that helped them along the way. If you want to get the episode highlights directly in your email, then head to theleapcast.com right now to subscribe. Hello, everybody. Welcome again to LeapCast. I'm your host, Dr. George James, and I'm here to have amazing, wonderful conversations with high achievers doing great things to learn and just to learn more about who they are. Today, I am super excited. I know every time I say I'm excited, but today I'm super excited for our guest today, Jeff Gibbard. I know him in so many ways. He's a great friend. And let me just tell you a little bit about him. First, for years, his LinkedIn headline said, the world's most handsome social media and content marketing strategist. But today he prefers to go by another title, superhero. As you can see, I got my superhero shirt on. That's right. We got to have a superhero connection going on. Jeff Gibbard is a strategy consultant, a coach, a professional speaker, author, and the founder of the Superhero Institute, a certification program for coaches. Jeff Gibbard is a superhero to everyone. He's also the author of soon-to-be-released book on leadership called The Lovable Leader. I'm just excited. Welcome, Jeff. Thanks for being on the podcast with me.
Hey, man. Thanks for having me. And George, I feel like this is not super different than what we would normally do, except we're recording it this time. But I really, I always love getting a chance to sit down and chat with you. And the fact that we're in like this more formal setting right here is kind of cool.
You're right. This is really just going to be what we normally would do. And so for everyone who's listening, the reason why I'm just so excited is that when I thought about doing a podcast, I couldn't think of anyone else to really go to and like, hey, how do I do this? What I need to do other than the awesome and amazing Jeff Gibbard, who amongst his many wonderful talents, he's also a podcast hoster and has been doing it for a number of years. So Jeff, I really appreciate you being willing to just join me on my journey.
Dude, I'm so glad that you have a podcast to bring into the world. I believe even before you launched the podcast, I might've been like, George, have you ever thought about releasing a podcast? Because you have one, you have the voice, two, you have the warmth, and then three, you're just brilliant. I know you can get the best out of people as being a therapist. It's like, you know how to listen, you know how to ask probing questions without, you know, judgment or anything, just like letting people kind of bring out what's going on with them. So if you tune that towards trying to figure out what makes leaders tick, I mean, I'm in. Oh. I was one of your first subscribers. I know that.
You probably were. And look, that's what I'm saying about like the connection. And I appreciate you so much. So like I said, I've known Jeff and I really want to get into part of this. How I usually like to start is getting into people's LEAP story. Just a reminder for everybody out there, LEAP stands for Leaders, Entertainers, Athletes, and Performers. And, you know, Jeff, you've done so much in your life. And I would love to just hear a little bit about your background. How did you get to where you are now? How did you even find the Superhero Institute? Like, how did you like lead into that or develop into that? So tell us a little bit about your backstory.
Yeah, I'll give you the few minute version that helps to encompass all of LEAP. So when I was 13 years old, I knew that I was going to be the starting point guard for the New York Knicks. So in a different timeline in the multiverse of things, I am here for the A portion of LEAP. So I thought that that was going to be the thing. So at 13, I thought that was going to be my thing. Went through high school believing that I was going to get recruited. All
right, so who was your favorite Nick then? If you're going to go that far, like, who was your favorite Nick?
So I actually was in on like the Latrell Sprewell years of things, like the kind of the later years. Because when it was in like, when I was in like my like 93 and 94, that was like back in like Chicago Bulls era, Michael Jordan. Of course I was down with the Bulls at that time. But the Knicks were my second favorite at the time. But I like that they played like that kind of like that bully ball. They had like the Charles Oakley, the Anthony Mason. It was like, you didn't want to go into the paint too much. So I was into that. And I, you know, being short, I loved like the whole point guard thing. Like I love the creativity of it. It just looked like jazz on the court. You know, like when somebody did something truly amazing or broke somebody's ankles, I was just like, that's amazing. It's beautiful to watch. And it's a little cocky. So I always really appreciated that. But needless to say, I did not become the starting point guard for the Knicks. No need to Google it, Wikipedia it. So I had to figure out like what was the backup plan. So I decided to go to school for film. So this is where I get into the entertainer part. I wanted to be working as a director and a screenwriter. I wanted to basically write stories and then help to make sure that it was told appropriately. So I wanted to tell great films like Stanley Kubrick and like Martin Scorsese and like Alfred Hitchcock and Quentin Tarantino and all of like my favorites at the time. And I went to Temple University for that. And I thought that's what I was going to do. And, you know, so that's like the high school to college part. But there was this other thing that happened to me. And I think we've talked about this before. I'm not sure. But I knew towards the end of high school that I wasn't going to be in the NBA. I knew that wasn't going to happen. So I had picked out the film school was going to be a thing. I was ready to go. This was my last day of high school. I take the car. My mom and I shared a car. I take the car, go to school. I'm like really excited. We're going to have a party. It's going to be a graduation party, whole thing. In the middle of the day, I met up with my mom and I gave her the car so that she could go and like pick up groceries for like this party we were going to have. And she wanted to go to like town over because they had the good fish at the grocery store. So I go back to school, come home after school, and I go in the front door and my grandmother is there. She came in for the party and everything. And she looked really sad. And I was like, what's going on? And she was like, well, your mother has been in an accident. And it turned out that my mother got into a catastrophic car accident where guaranteed overnight delivery, like this big tractor trailer truck, ripped off like the entire driver's side of her car. And she miraculously survived. Was in the operating room for like 8 or 9 hours, got like 8 or 9 pints of blood, was in a coma for like 3 weeks. And basically my last day of high school went from being this joyous moment of excitement to, oh, wow, like one of the most important people in my life, almost gone. Yeah. And not knowing if she was going to survive or any of that. So. You know, that's sort of part of the backstory, right? I wanted to do this thing that was chasing my passion, found this other thing that was going to be my passion, had this tragedy happen to me, go to school a few years later, 9/11. So it was like, I had this sort of like bouncing back and forth between like chasing passion and tragedy strikes out of nowhere. And you should always be on guard and always be vigilant. So that's a big portion of my story is this recurring theme of like, wanting to do something extraordinary. And I have a whole backstory about how the movie Superman came out the year I was born. There's a whole bunch there, but so much of it was about chasing passion, doing something that you love, finding something that excites you, and then having the flip side of it, constantly being, you know, reminded of the fact that you never know what's going to happen. You never know if you're going to get tomorrow.
Wow. Yeah. You know, Jeff, I don't actually remember that, or maybe we didn't get that far because like, as you're sharing that, I'm just thinking about how at such a young age, you had to learn that adversity and tragedy can happen in any moment, in any second. And so just curious, how did you navigate like the end of high school feeling all happy and then learning about your mom to like whenever you got to college? I don't know if it was later that summer or some other time, but how did you like handle that?
Quite honestly, it was just psychological numbing more than anything else. It was, you know, you just push through. So resilience for me at, you know, of all the things that happened to me in my life were just a matter of like, you just keep moving forward. Yeah. And to a certain degree, I still to this day look back and I honor the fact that like, I've had these experiences that allow me to be resilient in the face of things that happen. And that's a good thing. But the flip side of it, as you kind of pointed out, that reminder that it could happen at any time, is this constant state of hypervigilance, this always being on the watch for things. And I think part of what gives me this sort of like calling to like be the superhero and save the world and help people is that I realize that like life is short and horrible things can happen and some people suffer, and wanting to do everything I can to make sure that people live good lives, and that if I can be a resource and help people, that I do that. And again, a lot of that goes back to like, I really look at so much of like the origin of like, you know, this whole superhero thing. Yeah. All superhero stories start with trauma. Like they all start with something horrible.
It's deep and just traumatic.
Yeah. So I give this talk called Becoming Superhuman. I talk about how Superman 2 was released in 1980. That was the year I was born. And I was like super into Superman, like hardcore. And if you don't remember Superman 2, here's basically the lesson of Superman 2. Superman falls in love with Lois Lane, decides to give up his powers so he could have love. And as soon as he does that, the world falls under attack and he's left the world helpless. And he decides to basically sacrifice himself and try to walk back to the Fortress of Solitude to get his powers back, even though it could cost him his life. He could die because he's now immortal. And he goes back there and he gets back his powers. He defeats General Zod, the whole thing. And comes and he lets the president know at the end of it, he brings back the roof of the White House and he says, you know, I'm sorry I was away. I'll never let you down again, Mr. President. So as a child, I thought it was my responsibility to make sure I never let down the president of the United States. And in the minute I do something for myself, such as fall in love, horrible things will come to the people that I love. Oh, and P.S. in Superman 1, Lois Lane dies in a car crash in a car and he turns back time by flying backwards around the earth and turning back time. So it was like there were so many of those traumatic sort of like memories in my head at the time of my mom's accident. So anyway, that not to ramble on about it all, but
I really appreciate that because like what I'm thinking about is just how as a high achiever, as a leader, like or anyone in the leap, right? Entertainer, athlete, performer, there's this point where like some your passion, your purpose, some people, maybe even your calling is birthed out of like pain.
Yes,
right? It's birthed out of like really tough, horrible things, right? And somehow that allows you to say like, this is what I want to do in life, or this is how I want to help other people, or how I want to make sure other people don't go through what I go through. And I've heard that countless times, but I hear that so much in what you're saying in your story and just saying, look, I've been through some stuff and I don't want anybody else to have to go through it. But I might have to make some sacrifices along the way. So I can only imagine the sacrifices you've had to make to be a superhero. Like you said, Superman had to give up his love. Like, what would you say are some of those sacrifices you've had to go through to be the superhero?
I mean, I think the one that's really present for me and the thing that I've been working through over the past several years is I've really tried to like go on this path of the hero and like trying to do work that's meaningful and trying to make sure that the impact of my work, you know, is free from causing harm and is also in service of making the world a better, safer, kinder, more equitable place. Like to go down that route, I had to do a lot of internal work and look at how I'd been neglecting to take care of myself. Like the whole, I think recently we were having a conversation, we were talking about self-care and you use the term self-wellness, I think. And it like that whole concept of like, I'm allowed to take care of myself. I'm allowed to not be okay for a little bit. Like all of that was like brand new to me and I'm 41. And it's like, I only started working on this stuff in like my mid 30s. Yeah. So I think the real big sacrifice was like to continually get back up and be resilient in the face of things that happened in my life. My go-to was to bury it, to go and push through it and persevere. And I was able to accomplish a lot of things out of that, but I didn't pay enough attention to the residual damage that would cause. And sort of the things that I've learned through talking with my therapist are like trauma responses to things. Yeah. Like they're not exactly like necessarily always coming from the healthiest place. I think the intention is healthy, but they're sometimes coming from a place of really like a trauma response.
No, you know, what you're saying is also talks a lot to, you know, some of the therapists out there, right? Like there's a huge belief, right, that people who decide to become therapists are also coming from their own pain in some way. And, you know, I'm actually really grateful for the path I had to go through to learn more about myself, to be a therapist, to be there for other people, because I don't know what I would have done because I automatically have to work through so much as is. And if I didn't learn some of those things, I don't know what I would have done because even in my own experiences, I've learned about being resilient and that being like this kind of word that we embody and feel good about. But sometimes to be resilient, you've also stuffed some things or been through some things or haven't really dealt with some things. And so I could totally relate on this place that I have evolved to in my own life that I share with people about giving ourselves permission, right? To take care of ourselves, to do the self-care. And that still isn't easy because I'm out here trying to save lives too. And I know that you are as well. So it can be that wrestling between self-care while also, you know, taking care of the world. And I can only, you know, from hearing you, I can only imagine how you've navigated some of that.
Yeah. So one of the things that I say in my book about leadership is that leadership is, there are three lenses of leadership and they're always present at all times. Leadership is a burden, a privilege, and a responsibility. And I feel the same way about the work that I'm doing now or any type of work you're doing where you're trying to make a change is like, on the one hand, it's a privilege to be able to do that work, to make an impact, to have a positive impact on the world, right? Or the deference that people might pay you for the work that you're doing, right? At the same time, the responsibility is something that you feel called to, and it's something that to a certain extent you don't really feel like you can avoid, and that in some ways makes it a burden, right? So to take on the responsibility of like fixing the world sometimes really is a heavy burden to bear, and it's something that I talk a lot about, you know, when I'm trying to work through stuff, is like there has to be a distinction between doing this by choice and doing this because you feel that you have no choice but to do this, right? And I think that there's until you have the freedom to choose that you want to make an impact on the world in a positive way, it's not going to be as powerful as it possibly could be, because you're almost not a willing participant in it. Like you're kind of going along with it because of past traumas and things that you've been through.
I mean, that makes so much sense. Like when I think about the superheroes, and you know, once again, I think we're talking about superheroes, but we're also talking about leaders. We're also talking about people who feel compelled to just do good and do greatness in this world. And I think that there's, like you said, there's sometimes not this feeling of choice. It's like I have to, and then it is that burden. But to get to a place where I can freely choose, or that I can not only choose to do it, but I can also take care of myself and those I care about, or have, you know, I used to, growing up, I would look at people I would admire, and they would be these amazing individuals and just what they're able to accomplish. But then I would look at their home life. I would look at their family. I would look at their children. I would look at their relationship. And it didn't match up to all the greatness that they were doing. And I think that's also what compelled me to not only want to be a therapist, or to choose to be a therapist, but also to try to like do all of the work. Like, I don't want to just be a great therapist, right? But I also want to be a great father. I want to be a great husband. I want to be, you know, a great son, all of those things. And it's not easy to do that. But like, you know, that pull to try to balance all that. So like when you talk about all these different levels of being a leader, and just knowing you a bit, I'm wondering how have you expanded that outside of just the work, but into like your whole life?
So the premise that I operate from is actually one where I believe that applying the same principle across the board is the most effective way to go, right? So the lovable leader mentality that I have, you know, as a professional is the same one that I have as a husband. It's the same one that I have as a father, right? Because at the core of my whole philosophy around this is it's about care, it's about trust, it's about safe travels. So it's about setting goals that you can help people get to safely, and it's about showing people that you care and being trustworthy for them, right? And a lot of that, there's so many things wound up in that, but there's safety, there's kindness, there's respect, there's trust. So there's a lot of different pieces there. And I think that in any good relationship, whether it be professional, personal, whatever, if you don't have trust, if you don't sense that each other care about each other, and there's not a feeling of safety, you can't be vulnerable. You can't really connect. And I think, you know, let's take it completely out of the professional world. If I'm going to have a successful marriage, I have to have open communication with my wife. Yeah. We have to be able to be vulnerable with one another, because it's, you know, till death do us part. We're supposed to be here for each other through everything, ride or die, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, and if we don't trust each other, that when we bring our full selves to the table, that the other's not going to respond in a way that gives us a soft place to land, then we're going to start to retreat and we're not going to be as open. Yeah. And I don't actually think that's all that dissimilar to what you see in companies. When you see relationships in companies, when you go to your boss and you say like, hey, this thing is going on and I didn't feel right about how it went down, and they dismiss you, or they tell you that it's in your head, or they don't take action on it, or whatever it is, the trust starts to diminish. Yeah. And after a certain point, you know, a job is a whole lot different than a marriage. Like, you know, as someone who's been divorced, like I can tell you, that is a traumatic thing that happens, and it takes a lot of decisions, but yeah, leaving a job can be very easy if you don't trust your boss and you don't feel your boss cares for you, and it's not a safe work environment. Yeah. So I think so much of what you have to do to be successful in companies or on teams or any situation where there's leadership is that you have to have those preconditions, whether they're in your life, whether they're in, you know, the work part of your life or the personal part of your life. It comes down to relationships and communication and that feeling of connection. And that's built on, I think it's built on love, really.
Wow. Which makes sense, right? The lovable leader, right?
It's the whole idea, right? Like, and look, I also want to just say for the record, it's not easy. Like, no, it is not easy to approach every situation with love and kindness and care and trying to build trust and respect with people, because sometimes two people don't mesh. Like, they just don't jive. It's not gonna be a good fit. But like, I think you still have to try really hard to sit on the same side of the table with people and meet them where they are, try to see where they're coming from. And even if you don't like each other, you can still love and respect one another and kind of be there for one another as you need.
No, I mean, that to me, that makes so much sense. Like you said, it's not easy, but if you can have the same philosophy, the same through line of how you want to be, how you want to lead in your work and professional life, but also in your personal and romantic and community parts of who you are, at least you are consistent. At least you are showing up the same way.
Yeah. So, and I want to say just one more thing about it, just related to what I said before about it being your privilege, your burden, and your responsibility. I think you look at that in parenthood or in being a partner, a spouse, right? Like, it is sometimes a privilege for sure to be with your partner. Like, when I walk into any room with my wife on my arm, I feel like such a stud. Right. So it is a privilege to be her husband. And it is a privilege knowing the way that she treats me. Just, you know, I'm the envy of many of my friends, right? So that's a privilege, right? But at the same time, like, marriage is sometimes a burden, not because of necessarily the other person, but because if you have to deal with your own stuff sometimes. So like, you know, as someone who has ADHD, like if I get interrupted, I get very irritable, right? So it's a burden for me to have to go when I'm interrupted by her, like when she might be asking me something as simple as like, what do you want to have for dinner? It's a burden for me to fight that instinctual rise in me to be like, how dare you interrupt me? I was in the zone and this and that. When like, that's realistically like, what do I want to do in my relationship? What kind of relationship do I want to have? So it's a bit of a burden sometimes that you have to fight yourself to be the best version of yourself. And of course, you know, responsibility, obviously, like you have a responsibility to your partner, they have responsibility to you, and you have a responsibility yourself to not put too much responsibility and burden on your partner. So there's just a lot there that I think, again, it aligns with and mirrors with how I think about leadership.
I'm glad that you demonstrated that and kind of illustrated that. In terms of, you know, the privilege, the burden, and the responsibility, and how that really does show up in so many ways, that there it is a privilege. Like, I know that feeling. Like, I love being able to go out with my wife, do things with her, or for her to be happy. I feel like,
yeah,
I've done it, right? I'm there. But also, right there, like you said, there is the burden of what I need to do. And really, like you said, that's about checking myself, whether it is at the job or professionally or at home. I think for me to be a good leader, to be a good person, I have to be able to represent and check myself to figure out those things. And then there is some weight, responsibility, heaviness that comes with any good thing, in my opinion. And so I really like that you've kind of put that together in that way. So I'm curious, you know, you've had these kind of tough moments. I'm curious about a few things. One, in these tough moments that you've had, whether it be the accident with your mother or having to pivot in different parts of your life, like, who did you go to or how did you handle those particular situations?
Oh, so much of it was just, I'll handle this on my own. I think one thing that has helped me is my willingness to reinvent myself and change, to not be dogmatic about virtually anything, to hold myself too firmly to any one piece of my identity outside of my values. So like, the values have always been kind of the thing driving me, the sort of change I want to make in the world, sort of person that I want to be, but it doesn't necessarily constrain me to what I'm doing. You know what I mean? So I've always been flexible to that, but I knew I wanted to do something that I enjoy. And, you know, I knew one of my values is just getting back up. And honestly, I think that probably came out of, you know, the trauma of one, having to get back up at times, but two, I think when I look back on my early media influences of Superman getting up in those moments and just seeing in the stories that I gravitated to, all of the heroes always getting knocked down, but none of them ever stayed down. They always got back up. And I thought to myself, I'm never going to quit. Like, I'm never going to quit until my last day. And then I'll tell you another one. I just thought of this, but I often do relate this, is that I watched in when I was like 11 through 14, I had like a little bit of like a little depressive teenage angst thing going on. I was very like, you know, girl crazy. And like, I just had, and I was a little bit overweight and like, I had all these things going, right? So I was a little depressive. And I remember watching the movie Dead Poets Society. And it's a little cliche now, the whole Carpe Diem thing. But at the time for me, that was like a super groundbreaking thing that like, you don't know if you're going to have tomorrow. And I unfortunately found that out with my mom just, you know, about 4 or 5 years later. But at the time, I remember after seeing that movie, it was a little, you know, I'm short, I was a little heavier than I want to be. I had more red hair then and more freckles. And like, I just didn't feel super confident about myself at that time. But I remember I was about 14 at the time. It was after I saw the movie, and I sort of started trying to live each day, right? Like starting to really just not take life for granted. I remember looking at myself in the mirror before I was about to go out for something. And I just accepted myself. Like it was just a moment of like, I looked at myself and I said, look, no matter how much you hate on yourself for being short, you're short. No matter how much you hate on yourself for your weight, this is what you look like right now. Like if you want to do something about it, go do something about it. But like, and if you don't like your hair, that's your hair. Like, so what good is it taking your time just beating yourself up over who you are? And I thought that at 14, which in retrospect, as I describe it, sounds very, very mature. But I do remember it being like a pivotal moment for myself of just radical self-acceptance at that time. So it kind of put me in a position where it was very hard to harm me. Mm. Like it was very hard to hurt me because I already liked me. So if I like me, then like, what are you going to say that's going to actually hurt me?
Right. I mean, to me, that just sounds like, you know, we see in these superheroes so much, right, that they have this ability to be invincible. And like, we can have that in our teenage years, but I think that's emotional invincibility. Now, I just coined that term. I don't know where it came from.
We're just TM right here. We right. did that. Co-owned. Right. A nickel for each of us every time someone says it.
You know, I just think like that's a way, like when you can accept yourself and flaws and all, freckles and all, weight and all, height and all, whatever it might be, degrees or no degrees, if we can accept ourselves, nobody can do anything to you. And I think that's when you can, like you said, you can really live. And I appreciate that you shared that journey and how that got you to that place, because sometimes that's what we need in those moments, right? To remember, like, at the end of the day, I can do this. And the other thing I thought about is like, as much as sometimes people say that movies or comics or cartoons are like a waste of time, they can actually provide such value and mantras and energy and the get up, don't quit part that I even hear from that you were able to experience, which I just think is just fantastic. Because what if you didn't see those things? What if you didn't have those moments? Like, you might have just quit.
Yeah. Yeah, you never know. And what's funny about it is that even though I had that experience at 14 and there was a lot that I got out of that, I actually had to relive a similar experience in my 30s. So like talking about the leadership journey, you know, I started my own business at, I think I was 30 at the time where I started my agency. And being that was like my first time being like a quote unquote successful entrepreneur. That is, I could support myself. And I went through all of the trials and tribulations of being an entrepreneur, all of the imposter syndrome, all of the beating myself up, all of these things. And it wasn't until I might've been like 35 or 36 where I had this epiphany, but I actually realized that I'm pretty smart. And like, there are people that know me that would think that that's like kind of an absurd proposition. There might be people listening to that sounds like, oh, it sounds very arrogant, but no, like legit, like in high school and college, because of either because of my ADHD or just because of, you know, just the way school is not built for people like me, I was like, okay, I was like a B something student, but like I got by, I could rock tests because I had a great memory, but like I didn't really pay attention in school and I wasn't good at the busy work stuff and got distracted easily. And for a long time, I just thought I was like average and stupid, average and or stupid, right? And it wasn't until sometime in my 30s that I started to kind of learn how I work.
Yeah.
That I was like, well, I'm not stupid. I'm just different. Got it. Okay. So, and now I just have all of this residual trauma.
Yeah.
Of thinking that I'm stupid, right? That like everybody thinks I'm stupid. I would get on stage and I'd be like, they know everything I'm saying. And I get off the stage and people are like, what was all of that? Right. So it's just, it was a lot of like the demons in my head coming from these past experiences. So similar to that 14-year-old experience, I have to look at myself in the mirror now, today, even in my 40s, and look at myself and say, like, you're not stupid. Like, you're not the most brilliant person in the world, but like, you have value to contribute. Don't withhold your gifts from the world just because you have a 16-year-old that's living inside of you telling you that you're never going to amount to anything.
And, you know, I appreciate you sharing that because, you know, I talk a lot about those negative self-talk that we have, the negative thoughts, the record, the reoccurring loop that we have, the digital download that we have in our own minds that is often not positive. It's birthed out of some experiences that we've had. And to your point, like there's systems that are set up to make us feel. And I've seen that in people from all different walks, right? I've seen that with people who are, they learn different, people of different cultural or ethnic backgrounds, people of different gender or even sexual orientation, that there's certain things that make people feel like you're just not on the same level as other people. And yeah, it's false. And it takes a long time and a lot of work to really kind of push against that. So I'm really glad to hear that you've been doing that, like that you started at, 14, and then because you maybe learned that lesson, you've been able to do that again in a different way. And I've even had some conversations with people who haven't had traditional schooling, but have had what even call unschooling or have learned in other ways for those same reasons, because the other path had made them to feel like they're not good enough when they're brilliant.
Yep. I all of my best work, I think, happened after my graduations. It's where I learned everything, I feel like. I think there was some formal basis that I think has helped me to, I think of it almost as like learning a language. Like I honestly feel like business school for me was just language school because I learned the language of business, but I don't feel like I learned anything more about how to run a business necessarily, or I just sort of learned what the vocabulary was. And I learned that if I could frame things in certain ways versus other ways, then I'd be more successful when I'm communicating with people. But I don't think that it necessarily made me any more equipped. And I think a lot of what I found in learning was, just being my own version of a polymath or an autodidact, where like I would just learn from reading. I learned from online courses. I learned from, just studying people who are great at a thing. And that's how I've tended to get better at things.
And speaking about getting better at things, I know that you've had some tremendous moments. So what would you say, or maybe one or two highlights in your career, things that you say, that was just awesome, amazing, dope, that I was able to be able to do that?
So the truth is that one of the things I still struggle with to this day is that I get very excited about the before parts of things generally. And then after it happens, all I can see is everything I could have done better and the next version that I'm going to work on. I get excited about the next one. And then when that's done, I'm like, great, it was better. So I see slow progress, but in general, there's not too many things I look back on and I'm like, hurrah. But there are a few. And they actually have, I think, some very similar flavors to them. So I would say one of the first things that I'm most proud of is I have this whole move into the Superhero Institute. I have a talk called Becoming Superhuman. And I've given the talk to a lot of different audiences. And the audience that I love giving it to the most, I've done college lectures. And what I love about that is that I see potential for change. Yeah. I see the potential for taking people at an early part of their journey where maybe someone like me was sitting there thinking, I'm stupid. I'm just going to be average. I'm going to fail in life, whatever it might be that I'm having is negative self-talk. And here gets up this guy and delivers this talk on how you can unlock your potential, how you have the capacity to do it, and that there's literally nothing stopping you. You just have to find the modality that's going to work for you. But here's the process. It's these five steps. Let's go. And every time I've given that talk, I always focus on the negatives when I give a talk. Mm-hmm. But in those rooms, those are the ones where I focus on the positives. Nice. It's the people that talk to me after those that I go, I might have just changed someone's life. Whereas when I'm doing it at that middle level, that's where I'm like, okay, well, some people like it, but everybody else, they didn't like, not everybody liked me, right? Like I beat myself up over it. But when I've given those as college lectures, I've really, really appreciated that. And then I would say my crowning achievement for real, is writing this book, because it's the thing that I have poured the greatest degree of my heart and soul into. And I would honestly say it's the first thing that I've looked back on. And every time I've looked back on it and reread it, the different proof stages and everything, that I'm still actually proud of it, that I'm still proud of what I've put out into the world. And that no matter what happens with it, like it's very much that 14-year-old staring in the mirror moment. Like, I don't care if you don't like this book. I hope you do. I think I've put so much in it that's going to be valuable, but like, you random critic, I don't care if you don't like it, because I know I put my heart into it and I put it out into the world, and it's going to make a difference for the people who read it and who get it. And it's the same way that I felt about that college lecture when I've done it as a college lecture. It's not about the people in there that didn't get it, because they're going to walk away and they're going to find maybe something else that resonates with them. But for those that felt left out, that felt like they didn't have something that was for them, I was that in that moment for them. And I feel like my book is the same thing, because there's a lot of leadership books that are like how to grind it out, how to get your people to achieve more. And blah, 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 blah. It's the whole thing about like pushing your people to the max, hustle porn. That's not me. And mine is about creating better workplaces, safer workplaces, more collaborative workplaces, kinder, gentler, more loving people in work, because that's counterculture to what's going on. Most people just, they kind of show up, they do what they do, and they go home. And they try to, you know, ignore how much they hate their boss. So that's the thing I'm most proud of, is that book, because it's the thing I've worked on the longest and committed the hardest to. And I, at the end of it, still believe in it and care about it. You know, I ran an agency for 7 years, but like, I look back on that and it's kind of like the talks. I see all the things that went wrong. This book is the first thing where I'm like, just genuinely proud.
You know, for all those that listen, let me just be clear. You know, he ran an agency for 7 years. That was successful, right? But I totally love, you know, what you're sharing. And two things, I want to give two shout outs. One, I want to give a shout out to anybody who's listening that at some point you thought you were dumb or average or not good enough or not capable, or that you can't make it, or that it's not going to happen, because all of those things are lies. And I love what Jeff is saying, because he's saying he was in that situation. I have been in that situation. And those things we tell ourselves are such powerful lies that we believe it. But when we start to have a moment like that lecture you mentioned, where we start to poke holes in the lies and start to believe, wait, I'm brilliant. I'm smart. I'm capable. I can do something else. I could do a podcast. I could do a whole bunch of things. That's when you start to realize, well, what else can I do? And yeah. Shout out number two to the lovable leader. That is a different style, a different approach to leadership that Jeff just shared how he poured his heart into and time into and experiences. And so I just appreciate what you're saying so far, Jeff. And I think it's really touching on some people there who have doubted themselves. And I love your honesty too. Like, you're saying like, look, I still do it. And that's just,
yeah.
Like, I still like have those negative thoughts. I still don't always see the good in the things that I'm doing, but there's some things that I know that I put my time, my heart into that I can't see, but the brilliance and the awesomeness in it. And I appreciate you for being that candid in just your experience.
Thanks, man. And I want to give one more quick anecdote, if I could, for the first shout out that you gave about if you felt stupid somewhere. The additional thing I would add in there is, don't sell short how smart you actually are to someone else because of what you're good at. And I'll give you the real quick example of this, because this was probably the illuminating moment that set me on the path to start thinking, maybe I'm actually pretty smart. And it was this. It was in my MBA course. So I got my MBA at LeBeau College of Business at Drexel.
Nice.
And I arrived. And prior to this, I had like zero business experience, like none, zero, not at all. I tried to start a personal chef service that basically I could cook, but it failed miserably as a business because I didn't know a thing about business. So I get to this business school. Mostly my experience is having worked as a
waiter. I'm having Jeff over for dinner. I didn't know that part. I just learned.
Oh, for real. This is happening. Yes. I got to send you I have an Instagram. It's called Love Pie Kitchen. You can see what I cook.
Oh, yeah. Love it. Go ahead.
Yeah. So anyway, so I show up at the MBA and, you know, I'm kind of a cocky dude as it is in general. So I feel like I'm going to have no problem with this because like, whatever, I'll just fake it till I make it. Well, 2 weeks in, I'm feeling like, oh my God, I've made the biggest mistake of my life. I'm such an outcast here. Everyone else is so smart. I'm so stupid. I don't know a thing about accounting. I don't know a thing about finance. What is statistics? Like, I was never any good at any of these things. And I was just like catatonic in this space, right? So I'm like, maybe this waiter wasn't meant to be, you know, in an MBA class. All right. So I muscle through it. I tough it out and I'm halfway through the program. And all we've done so far is accounting and finance and economics and statistics. And I'm like, is this really what business is about? Just that, because this is horrible.
Yeah.
We get to the like basically the third quarter of the game. And we're in our first course that's really outside of that. It's called organizational behavior. It's about like, you know, team dynamics and things like this. We have to give a presentation. Now, mind you, the entire time so far, I've been like asking people for help for my accounting homework, my finance homework. I was like, helpless. Please just help me get through this program so I can get a job. We get to this third part, and all of those same people that I had been like, can you please help me with accounting? Can you please help me with finance? I saw fear in their eyes that I have not seen since me watching horror movies when I was a kid. Like pure, pure, undeniable terror. And like sweaty palms and everything. Jeff, can you please do the presentation? And I was like, the presentation? You mean like standing up in front of people and talking and making it entertaining and interesting? That's Yeah, I'll do that. And it was at that moment I was like, this thing that for me is like literally like a no-brainer. I'll put together a keynote. Great. I'll do this. I'll make it. I did this whole thing. And it was no problem for me, but they were catatonic about it in the same way that I was about accounting. And it was at that moment I realized everybody has a role. That's one of the things I say that I learned in my MBA is that everyone has a role, and your role doesn't have to be what somebody else's role is. And you don't have to anchor yourself to what their version of success is. Because the thing that you might look at them and say, wow, they're so smart, I'm so stupid. You know a thing. And they would go, oh my God, how? And it's not always the thing that's like traditionally valued, right? Like maybe you can't balance your 401k, or like, you know, you don't understand how a mortgage works or whatever, whatever the thing is, right? That's like a traditional definition of success. Like you've got money, you've got this. Maybe it's that everybody likes you. Yeah. And nobody likes that person because they are condescending and rude and this and that. Like it could be that your people skills are just crushing it and magical and people love you. It could be that you know how to cook and they don't. It could be that it could be you're in a happy marriage and they're in a miserable one. Like there's so many facets of life where you have something to contribute that somebody else doesn't know a thing about. So find what your genius zone is and appreciate that thing. And then like, you know, cut yourself some slack. Be gentle with yourself, as my therapist says.
Oh, I love it. Jeff, I need to find me like a LeapCast horn or something, right? Like you just like drop like dimes. That's it right there. You drop dimes and I love it, right? This thought of like, not only know your role, which so many people don't embrace, but recognize like you have greatness in you, like however you show up. And like, as you were talking, I'm like, my hands up, that's me, right? I know it, there's some things. And it took me a little bit even to embrace that, yeah, not everybody can connect with people the same way or just start talking and be okay with it. And
yeah.
And make sense while you're talking. It feels like you don't know what you're talking about maybe in your head, but to everybody, they're like, wow. And so I really appreciate just highlighting that some more. Look, Jeff, you and I could talk for a long time. And
We could do one of those like 3-4 hour sort of ones. Maybe easily.
That's easy. Yeah. As we're coming to, and there's a couple of questions I like to ask people. One is, if you could work with anybody or collab with anybody, do some type of project with anybody, who would you love to do it with?
That's such a good question. Because it's changed so much over the last few years. Like there's certain people that like I really admire that they do a particular thing. But lately I've been really trying to push myself far, far outside my comfort zone and be in spaces where I'm not the smartest person in the room on a particular subject. Because I think I over-rotated on like, I'm stupid. So I'm like, all right, I'm going to show up in rooms and be the smartest on this thing. But that's tough. It's hard to say. I can give you like a sort of a destination, but not necessarily a person. Although I could probably give you some people. I just know too many people that I'm like, they're awesome. I would work with them. I want to eradicate homelessness. Yeah. So I would want to collab with anybody where I could give whatever I've got to help make that happen. I work with a nonprofit called Pathways to Housing PA, and I'm really trying to help them end homelessness in Philly. But if there was somebody who was like, I'm on this, I'm like, you know what? No, here's what it was. I want Elon Musk in a room. I want to sit down. And I want to convince him to take some of that ridiculous amount of money that he's got and just fix homelessness and poverty in this, and like not necessarily poverty. He won't do that, but maybe child hunger or something like that. And homelessness, like you can do it. You got enough. You got that money in like, you know, in petty cash, probably
somewhere. So, and you know, what's crazy. I've heard, and my wife in public health has shared this with me often. There's enough wealth in the world that even just a small fraction of it would
fraction of fraction. Yeah.
Hunger across the world. So
it's something like $20 billion would like eradicate homelessness in this country, like eradicate it. And like, we should just do that. Like, why haven't we done that? Why should people be sleeping on the street? It's mind boggling to me. So yeah, maybe that would be it. But there's so many people that I've met in recent years that like, I'll just give shout outs to like Christina Blacken, Christopher Lynn, Yvonne Alston. Like there's just so many people I know recently that I've come into contact with that just have challenged me in so many ways and educated me. And I feel like made me a stronger leader and a better person that I could list probably like 400 people.
That's cool. I know you've been working on Lovable Leaders. You've shared, you talked about like even your work with like trying to eradicate homelessness. is there anything else or more about the book that you'd like to share that you're working on currently, or anything that else that you're working on currently?
I'm constantly working on so many different projects. You know, The Lovable Leader is my top priority right now, because again, it's something that I'm so proud of. It's also something that, you know, candidly, I have so many insecurities about. It's my first book launch. It's my first book being released. I'm like, man, nobody's going to buy it. Everybody hates me.
Do you have a date yet?
January 22nd is, I think what it was. It's January 2022, but I think it's 22nd, maybe 25th. Right. It's something. It's in that range. So main thing is, it's a book for new leaders. And like, I think that's a space that is underserved. I'm not trying to talk to like Fortune 500 CEOs. They got enough books written for them. Yeah. I'm talking about somebody who just got put in a new manager's role. They've never managed people. Mm-hmm. What do you do? Right. And you're reading these books by somebody who's like, oh, I ran a team of 800 people. And so, like, that doesn't help you. You need a book that teaches you, how are you mentally going to manage this? Yeah. What are some of the strategic and logistical things that you need to think about? How do you deal with self-care? There's a whole chapter on self-care. Nice. Because being a leader can suck. So, you know, I would love to see this book make a difference out in the world. And the dirty secret of it is that the majority of the book was written as a counterbalance to everything I hated about bad bosses. And I feel like if we're being real about it, this is the antidote to bad bosses. If more people were like this, more people could go to work and at least get along with the people they work with, and at least respect that they have their hearts in the right places. And maybe we can make working not such an awful thing. We can make it something that we literally want to do.
Right.
And so there's that piece.
And to your point, to be a superhero, sooner or later, you're going to need an antidote to something. There's going to be something, some poison, some kryptonite, and you need the antidote. And so I love like The Lovable Leader as an antidote to bad bosses, bad work environments, bad managerial skills, all of that. I love it.
So I'm trying to build my launch team right now of all the people and folks that are going to support this launch, you know, write an Amazon review when it comes out, you know, pre-order the book when it comes out, all that sort of stuff. So like, we can at least give it a fighting chance of getting in front of the right people so that maybe we can change the culture a little bit. And that's what it's all about. Ultimately, kinder, safer, more equitable world.
Well, you know, I'm going to support, I'm going to write a review. So that's going to be easy. And, you know, we're here talking about it on Leapcast. So I hope and believe that, you know, others will support it as well. Last two questions. Thank you. Last two questions. What does mental wellness mean to you?
Mental wellness, that's what it was, not self-wellness. What does mental wellness mean to me? I mean, I think it's a couple things. I think one is having some sense of what happens in your head. Like mindfulness, I guess, would be the catch-all term for it. So I think one is differentiating that just because you think a thought doesn't mean it's true, and giving yourself the space from that thought, giving yourself the ability to have some say in what's going on in your mental state. This morning, I was a little bit exhausted. I went to bed a little too late. And I was feeling low energy. And I said, you know what? Like, what does that energy pattern feel like in my body? Can I choose to actually change the way my energy feels in my body and actually get excited about when I get back home, sitting at my desk and getting right to work? And I was able to do it. I can't do it every day, but like today I was able to do it. And I think that's one aspect of mental wellness. I think the other is related, but it's about your self-talk. It's about being able to monitor it, interrupt it sometimes. Yeah. And then finally, I think it's about giving yourself the space to sometimes be broken, for lack of a better term. Is like, you don't always need to be on and right and perfect and strong. Like, I think, and especially I can say this just as you know, cisgendered heterosexual dude, it sometimes feels like it's weak to be anything other than all put together and stiff upper lip. And I got to tell you, bawling my eyes out a couple times in recent years has been some of the most freeing, liberating thing to just let go of that pressure, to just bottle it up and march forward as if everything is perfect. Life's hard. Yes. And I think part of mental wellness is giving yourself a break from having to be that, you know, just let it go. Give yourself a chance, man.
And you know, when you share that, like that means a lot. And just the other day I had to facilitate a conversation and I was sharing some things about my family and so forth. And I got emotional and I'm like, look at me, I'm getting all emotional and I'm just going with it. And everybody's going there with me. And at one point, I wouldn't have done that. And I love that level of just freedom, because like you said, we don't have to have it all put together. And sometimes it's even better when we just allow however we are to just show up.
100% agree, man.
Last question. What mental wellness advice would you give to your younger self? And that could be as young as yesterday or any time before that.
I would definitely have started therapy much earlier in my life. For sure, that would be my number one piece of advice. Is I think everybody should have a therapist, and I think every couple should have a couples therapist. And I want to put out there so that there's no sense that there's, you know, conflict of interest here, but like, I'm on the board of Counsel for Relationship. You work at Counsel. We met through Counsel, and like, we're both obviously very big advocates of mental health. And I'm not trying to stir up business for Counsel. You want a therapist, great place to go for sure. But I will say that my experience of having joined the board and getting involved with the organization was what led me to getting a therapist. And it has truly changed my life. And I would recommend it to anyone. And I would definitely give that to myself as a piece of advice. The second thing I would say, and this is just specifically because of the way that my brain processes things and the idiosyncrasies of ADHD, but I would say, like, don't put the pressure on yourself for your brain to operate any other way than the way your brain does. And try to figure out how to work with it rather than against it. You know, there's this whole concept in the ADHD community about masking, where you are able to present to people in such a way where they go, oh, you have ADHD, I have no idea, right? So they don't understand the storm. They don't know the chaos that is reigning inside of you at times. And I think for me, one of the things that I would have really benefited from is accepting that that's how I am and learning earlier to find ways of working with it rather than fighting against it. Because when I'm able to work with it, I mean, magic happens. There are benefits to it. You know, the hyper-focus side of ADHD is remarkable. And I think if you are someone who has trouble with focus, if you can find out ways to engage your flow state like that, like I've learned how to do, more often than not, I still have my, like, you know, my executive dysfunction moments of like nothing works. Right. But the more you can mitigate that, I mean, I think the more you can become superhuman. Like, that's part of what mental wellness is like figuring out how this one that you have, that is yours and yours alone, figure out how that one works. And that's what I would have said to myself.
I love work with your brain, not against it. And really just highlighting like ADHD and so many people who might either be diagnosed or undiagnosed and have had those struggles because they are working against their brain. And like you said, with everything that we could have, there is a gift that can come with it if you allow yourself to see it. And I appreciate you also owning and naming that we are both a part of Counsel for Relationships in different ways. But as we know, that LeapCast has had the ability to reach people from all over. So you can find a therapist wherever you are. The key is definitely to find the therapist.
Exactly.
Jeff, this has been just amazing. And like you said, we could have easily had one of those 4-hour podcast sessions. There's so many things that we still didn't even get into. I appreciate you stopping by, being here. And also for everyone that's out there, influencing me, encouraging me, coaching me up, helping me to be your host for LeapCast. And I would not have been able to be in this role and to grow in this role if not for the support of Jeff. So in so many ways, Jeff, thank you. Author of The Lovable Leader, as well as just an awesome, amazing person, strategist, business person, but really just an amazing leader. Jeff, thank you for joining.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me. I believe in George James.
I'll take that. All right. Wow. What an incredible ride we just went on with another great member of the LeapCast community. I appreciate you listening and hope you got some tangible value from the episode. Please let us know what you think by leaving a comment, rating, and review. As always, please don't forget to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. This is Dr. George James, and I'll see you next time.